Before I say anything else, I need to apologize. According to the program, my co-author, Jane O'Donnell, was Jane D. O'Donnell, which is wrong because I sent her the wrong initial. Her real initial is E, and I even know what it stands for. So I just wanted you to know that, Jane, and I want everybody else to know that I may be stupid, but I'm not ignorant. There are, as of course you know, a lot of color pairs, what one might call color pairs in Heteropterin, probably in other groups as well. And by that I mean two species that are not necessarily related, and in fact may be very distantly related, that are of the same bright color and sometimes of the same or similar patterning, as in this case. Many of these, at least in the Heteroptera, consist of a potential prey species, a herbivore, and a potential predator. But it's not always clear that the predator does in fact prey upon the herbivore species that looks like it. Nevertheless, many of these species are sympatric, and there are also other kinds of pairs, a herbivore-herbivore pair, and I'll show you one or two of those. And there are also, I imagine, predator-predator pairs, but I don't have any examples of. So what I'm going to do now is show some pictures of these, and I need to explain that a lot of these pictures are faded and drab because these specimens have been sitting out in my lab for at least a year and a half. Jane took the pictures and did her very best, and while she was doing her very best, I could hear her muttering under her breath things that I refused to listen to. So let me go through a few of these. This is a pericorid on the left and a red Javid. By the way, if you want the full identification of these, the full determination of these, email me and I'll send you the species. I don't have them here. A pericorid on the left, a red Javid on the right, African.
Wow.
Pericorid on the left, a ropalid on the right, two herbivores. Pericorid on the left, red Javid on the right. Ropalid, a Leptochorus on the left, a Dysdercus, pericorid in the middle, and a red Javid on the right. And finally, for this sequence, an elided, a rice bug, Leptochoriza on the left, and a red Javid on the right. And in all cases, these occur, at least they occur in the same general area. I have no evidence that they actually occur together in close companionship. Now, there are, I think, several explanations for these similarities. One of them, I think, is poor, if not silly. The others are not incompatible with one another, and it's possible that, and I'm sure there are additional explanations, because I just sort of spun these off out of my somewhat disorganized mind. Let me dispose of the first one, the one that I think is unlikely. And this is the phenomenon that's known as aggressive mimicry. And basically, aggressive mimicry says that a predator looks like a prey in order to sneak up on it and grab it. And it seems to me this is, to put it as gently as I can, unlikely. First of all, most important predators for insects, I think, are not other insects or other arthropods. I think they're most likely to be vertebrates, birds, reptiles, to some extent amphibians, and small mammals. And among the small mammals, particularly rodents, and I think it's no coincidence, the largest group of mammals are small rodents, which feed mostly on seeds and on arthropods. Second, most vertebrates use sight, at least in some part of their prey-catching activities. They get their prey at either the beginning or the end through sight. Aggressive mimicry assumes that arthropod predators look like their arthropod prey in order, as I mentioned, to sneak up on them and be unkind to them. And the assumption behind this is that arthropods see other arthropods the same way that vertebrates, including us, see arthropods. And I think that's, as I say, at best unlikely and at worst silly. I mentioned it's a weird notion. One proponent of aggressive mimicry was Breton, and in in describing or explaining the similarity between a Phoenoctonus species, a Regivian, and a Dysdyrchus species, a Pericurid, he described it this way, and I won't repeat the German because I don't want Christiana to be embarrassed by laughing at my pronunciation, so this is my translation. Quote, apparently this is another case of aggressive mimicry. Under the mask of a friend, perhaps of a love-seeking Liebesuchende, conspecific, the Phoenoctonus creeps up on the carefree, the word here is arglosen, which is sort of, I like to think of as happily innocent, the carefree Dysdyrchus, in order to rear above him, not for mating, but in order to bring to him the death-dealing stab. Den Toplingen den Stich. I think that's just lovely. And I wish I'd had time to make an image of this creeping up. I like to think that it probably hums a gentle little love song. And then... anyway. So if these things look alike, not because the predator is going to sneak up and amorously stab the prey, why do they look alike? Well, I think there are several possibilities, and one of them I think might be called group warning. That looking alike, to warn away sight-using predators, not by an individual's warning color, but by the mass of warning colors created by the gathering together of many similarly colored bugs. If this is reasonable, and I think it is, in fact, I suggested this as an explanation for the aggregation of Parastrachia, and Lisa can tell me if I'm crazy. And if it's true that vertebrate predators are more important as predators of bugs, of insects, or at least of pteropods, if that's true, then it would be an advantage to everybody to have lots of same-colored aposematic bugs clustered together, warding off predators from a distance. And although even a few like-colored bugs together might be a deterrent, I would assume that the larger the mass of deterrent color, bright red or whatever, the better. Because the larger the mass of deterrent, the larger the deterrent mass, the greater the distance that the predator will stay. And the predator that stays far away does not kill as many insects as the predator that comes up close. And so a mass of color is more beneficial to the members of that mass than would be a single individual, however brightly and warningly colored. So if arthropod predation is less important than vertebrate predation, and a big bunch of color is better than a little bunch of color, then the advantage to herbivores to joining such an association, even with predators, that advantage would be greater than the disadvantage of the occasional predation upon those herbivores by those predators. Now another possible explanation, which is not in conflict with, but in fact would accompany the group warning explanation, is the fact of biochemical constraints. First of all, the basic ground color of insects, of course, is brown, light to dark brown to almost black. And this is achieved or accomplished. It's a measure of the consequence of the degree of oxidation of tyrosine in the cuticle, and to some extent the degree of tanning, but primarily the oxidation of tyrosine, which is a very simple, it's what you see when you cut open an apple or a potato and it turns brown. It's very simple. It's what happens when you're out in the sun, the skin you get dark because your skin is saying you're really stupid to be out in the sun where the ultraviolet can damage you, so skin is smarter than you are and it's going to turn brown and protect you from the ultraviolet. It's a very simple reaction. But if brown is the basic, and it is, since brown is the basic ground color of insects, and if there is some evolutionary constraint, I have to be teleological because it's so much easier, if there's some evolutionary adaptive advantage to being in contrast with brown, the best colors to do that are white, yellow, orange, and red. If you're blue or green or what, these are not good contrast with brown. Well, of these colors, at least the last three, yellow, orange, red, are biochemically similar. They are steps along a fairly simple biochemical pathway. Therefore, well, let me divert this. The same, I think, is true if the ground color overall is to change from some form of brown to something else, something aposematic, something, well, not like those, but something bright. It's more likely to turn to white, yellow, orange, or red. Those are the easiest, in teleological terms, those are the easiest colors to which brown can, into which brown can change. These are the easiest, which, by which I simply mean they're the least energetic. They require the less energy to become. If this is so, then it's not difficult, evolutionarily speaking, for aposematic insects to arise, and if they're cone-specific herbivores, to aggregate on the same food plant and start forming and form a mass. Other like-colored species may then also arise, either convergently or as mimics, Batesian or Mullerian mimics. If mimics, it is clearly adaptably good for the mimics to be part of the aggregation of which the models are another part. If the similar color or similar pattern arises by convergence, it would still be biologically useful to be part of the aggregation, or at least to be part of an association of the few. As soon as I wrote that phrase, I began to think of our president, but never mind. But how these would find one another, I don't know. I haven't speculated that far. So if this is so, and if the type of aposematic coloring is constrained biochemically to yellow, orange, red, it seems reasonable that one should expect that similar colors and patterns would arise convergently in quite different parts of the world. Here is a pericorid from Bolivia and a regevid from Africa. Now, no one could ever suggest that one arose because it was going to sneak up from, say, move from Tanganyika and slip over and bring the death-dealing stab to the Dysdurcus on the left. And here's a pericorid from Africa and a regevid from Florida. And to this group, you might also, in your mind, add the large milkweed bug, Oncopeltis satiatus, especially the red-orange form, not so much the pale-orange form, the red-orange one, looks very much like this. So maybe it's not good to be green. So then, do I have time for another disposition?
Yeah. 4 minutes.
4 minutes, okay. I don't really have any summary for this except to go to repeat what I said in 4 minutes, which I do not intend to try. But I did then start asking myself, why are so many of the associations, and there are lots of other associations that I would have shown you, except the specimens were so dusty, even Jane in her interesting vocabulary would be unable to have made them worth photographing. But the question then occurred to me, why are so many of these associations, these color similarities, these color pairs, whatever one calls them, why are so many of them a pericorid regevid association? And the short answer to that question is, I don't know. But the more speculative one is, perhaps I just noticed pericorids more because I studied them somewhat, and I've got more of them in my collection. And maybe I know regevids more because I've got a fair number of them identified from South India, identified by Dunstan and Ambrose. So maybe I'm just more aware of them. I don't know. But then I wonder. I suspect that a larger percent of pericorid species, even excluding Dysdurcus, that a larger percent of pericoid species are aposematic than of other pentatomomorphin groups. Maybe. It seems to me that's the way. Then, having thought of that, which is may or not be, that may or may not be true, but at this point I don't care because it leads on to another thought, which also may or may not be true. And maybe each family group, and I'll give some examples, maybe each family group has a kind of basic defense method. Method, by the way, you notice, is a useful word because it can suggest either behavior or some structural modification. So here's some things that occur to me. Pericardy, bad taste and aposematicism, and to some extent, and some mimicry. There are certainly mimics in pericardy, especially in some of the Asian ones. And it could be, and the interesting thing about Dysdurcus is that it's warningly colored underneath, more so than it is from above. But nevertheless, it's warningly colored. So pericardy, their basic defense method is tasting bad, probably, and being aposematic. The tribe, then the other family in the pericardy is the Largidae. If we look at the subfamily Largini, we have the tribe Largini. That's mostly Largus in the New World. In fact, the entire subfamily Largini is New World. Some of these are contrastingly colored, but for the most part, I don't know what if they have any basic. My God. Okay. Let me summarize the next 75 pages. The defense mechanisms are things like ant mimicry, which occur, and these things occur at least in the pentamomorpha. These things occur not individual, not scattered throughout a family group, but they are characteristic of family groups, either of immature Alladines or of adult and immature Colobathristids or of microlacrinolitids and so on. Small insects, small bugs, certainly the group that I'm interested in, tend to have spines on them. On the thorax and on the scutellum. Some of these things, there's a tribe of Physopeltine pericards that is huge, this long, and vividly red. So I think, there may be something to the notion that these groups have some kind of fundamental, basic, whatever you want to call it, family group trait which in they use for protection. That's it.
Question?
I hope not. Yeah, Toby.
It seemed to me that if you contrast it pericoroids. I can't tell Larkin from Pyrocordis, you probably can. As you would come to the conclusion that they both have the capability, both families have the capability to produce this red and black stuff.
Producing what? I'm sorry.
Both of them can produce red and black
form.
So have you looked at the food plants? Scott might have some comments on that. But have you looked at the plants that they're eating to see if they're picking up toxic compounds for it?
Dysdurcus and some of its relatives, most of them to me, and to most people, they exist in museums as corpses on impaled on pins, but some Dysdurcus feed on the same sort of things that Leptochorus and Jadera do. No, they don't. They don't feed on the same thing.
Malvalian.
Right.
Are there any toxic compounds?
I don't, as far as I know. I don't know. I mean, this is the group to which cotton belongs. You know, these Dysdurcus are cotton stainers, as you know. So, what?
Weed cotton oil.
Yeah. So I don't know. I know. Well, let me put it more negatively. I have no evidence that any of these insects get noxious compounds from their food. That doesn't mean that they don't have them, because they could manufacture them. But as you know, for the most part, that doesn't happen. But then the question is, I also don't think that these Regevians are so host specific that they would only feed on prey that have these toxins in their own bodies. Because if the argument is that you only get toxins from the food that you eat, then clearly the Regevians would have to be getting it from their insect prey. And I don't think there's that degree of specificity in these. And Christiana can correct it.
We're actually out of time.
Yeah, well. Is there a hand? I can't. Jay, could you? Jeez, it takes forever.
You have a quick question.
Jay, would you answer?
You may be making, I can't deny the possibility that you're talking about, but at least in some of these, I think probably they have nothing to do with each other. You get the green animals, predators and phytophagous feeding on green plants.
Mm-hmm.
You get the same thing with brown animals feeding on brown plants, brown grasses, whatever. And so they may not have anything to do with predator prey relationship, but rather adaptation to the substrate.
Yeah.
To prevent predation from something else. And also, in something like this, you could have this kind of barring effect, which is a way to break up the
family. Oh, yeah, yes.
And
yeah.
Again, once again, you don't have a relationship
exactly.
Between the two. They're completely independent.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, you have them in these, from Mozambique and Florida.
I can't help, now that I've got the floor again, I can't help but observing that in research groups like periophthalmos, or largest for the lymphoma, the nymphs of the immigrants are felt completely different.
Yeah.
That.
Well, I mean, it's like elidids, elidines, where the nymphs are antimimetic, and the adults, to the extent that anybody seems to know, maybe wasp mimetic when they fly. Nymphs are characteristically much different from the adults. Feed on different, in many cases, feed on different plants, have different ways of life. Which, if since they can't fly, to some extent, is a different sport that may be forced upon them.
Sort of working on the nymph species. You know better than I, but the most obvious red and black things are Charistrachia and Dipneusis. Almost nothing else does this.
Well, there are.
Really uncommon by comparison. These were for almost everybody.
Yeah, but it's somewhat more common. There's some Edessines, for example, that are quite contrastingly and brightly colored. But you're right, as looking at the family as a whole, they are mostly green and
beautiful.
Thank you.